data is a way to build up the institutional trust in the organization rather than an individual person. That is, it cuts really deep because the reader, the consumer, no longer looks at that organization as somebody that's trying to take something from them, but the organization has been educating them, and that organization has been doing it very generously, and they've been sharing information, and they've been helping out, and you can trust them.
Hello again, and welcome back to Funnel Vision, where we're speaking with leaders in digital marketing who are thinking big and leaving their mark on the industry. Consider this an opportunity to stop and reflect and learn from some of the industry's best. I'm Paola Mejia.
And I'm Sasha Belanke.
Let's get started.
So today on the show, we have Eitan Buchman. Eitan is the Chief Marketing Officer at Freightos, a groundbreaking digital freight booking platform. That's freight, as in the heavy lifting of the logistic world. The ships, planes, trains, and automobiles allowing global supply chains to move products from point A to point B. Eitan has been instrumental in scaling the company from a small team to a NASDAQ-traded company. Eitan is known for his infectious energy and commitment to data-driven marketing. The New York Times even bestowed upon him the title of Freight Nerd. What an honor. Eitan is really passionate about the power of data storytelling to drive performance and create compelling content. And under his leadership, Freightos has done a remarkable job of just that. And that's what we're here to talk about today. Eitan has also taken a keen interest in artificial intelligence, sharing his constant thoughts and learnings on LinkedIn. I especially love his series on AI dad hacks, not just for dads, also for moms. Eitan, welcome to Funnel Vision.
Thanks. I kind of want to finish the podcast now after that intro. I can't do much better. This has been a great podcast.
Eitan, but seriously, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's such a pleasure. Really looking forward to this.
I'm very interested about the AI dad hacks / mom hacks. We'll definitely be checking that out. But before we move on to that part, could you tell us a little bit more about how you got to Freightos and what it is exactly? Because I think that world, we all depend on it, but not a lot of us know what it is until there's a supply chain crisis like during COVID or something. So can you just make sure we're all on the same page and kind of lay that groundwork for us?
Yeah, 100%. As you say, I think most people really only discovered international freight when they didn't have toilet paper. I need to plan a little bit before that. Yeah, so I did not grow up dreaming about getting into freight, right? Believe it or not, this was not been an aspiration from when I was four. I was in government for a long time. I've always been a little bit of a geek. I've always been a programmer, whatever. And at a certain point, I was like, okay, I want to get into tech. This is like where I belong. And I'm very methodical about it. I looked at a bunch of different companies that were out there, cold outreach to founders, really filtered out ones that had interesting stories that seemed like they really animated me, and then just wrote I think I was watching West Wing at the time. So I was like channeled my like inner Martin Sheen president and just wrote these long, very not best practice emails out to 10 or 12 different founders that I thought had interesting stories, and happened to bounce my way through that outreach to Freightos. Had no experience whatsoever with freight before. But what immediately struck me when I was speaking to Tzvi, our founder at Freightos, on his porch, this was literally starting in his basement, was this idea of like Space Mountain, but with the lights on. You suddenly see everything behind the scenes of the underpinnings of the world. And it just spoke to me. It was like something really, it's not to take away from other apps, but it's not like the social media thing. It's something like really real, really practical, something that really touches us. And I'm still like 11 years later, every time I pick up a glass, I look at the bottom and say, where was this made? And you start to understand how deep it goes and how important it is. And maybe also the importance of having a real mission. But that's like how I got into freight. And I've just been here and still amazed with it 10 years later. It's been a really fun ride.
Amazing. So the reason we brought you here, apart from talking to us about the importance of freight and supply chain logistics, is actually about storytelling, because you are very well known for having taken a topic that is in some ways not so easy to connect to, that often people don't think about, and creating really amazing, compelling data-driven stories around it. And just to talk a little bit about data and storytelling and how important it is in the marketing world, I'm sure everyone listening to this podcast is very aware of efforts like Spotify's Wrapped, which takes all of your data at the end of the year and gives you a snapshot on how you've connected with a product, and that's very personalized to you as the user, and obviously creates a lot of connections to wanting to do it more and thinking about what you want next year's to look like or what it will say. Similarly, Google Maps, I think, has a similar thing. At the end of the year, they tell you everywhere you've been. So if you're into traveling, it gives you the snapshot on your life. And Zillow is another brand that from day one has used data to tell very compelling stories, connect users to their brands. For B2C marketing, I think the data storytelling option, it's more well-known, maybe easier to relate to, but you have, like you said, every time you pick up a glass, there is a story there and you have access to all sorts of information around the movement of goods and challenges and opportunities that are created by the global economy. And you've created a brand for Freightos out of that. So we'd love to hear more about the thinking behind it, how you did it. It's definitely not easy to do, and we'll get into that. But yeah, what do you think about it when I say, how did you do it?
Yeah, gosh. I mean, you know, I would start with like, why? Why is it so effective, and why does data become such an important part of the equation? Not certainly not the only part of the equation, but why is it so important? And think about it, I think there's two different directions where it really hits. On the B2B side, I think one of the perennial like struggles that every B2B marketer has is that you're almost always marketing to somebody that knows more about a topic than you know. So in my space, I'm marketing to whatever, the logistics manager who's living and breathing international freight. But if you're selling DevOps software, you're selling to a DevOps person and they know their challenges better than you ever will. So your number one challenge is, how do I educate somebody enough that they'll actually find what I have to say interesting, even though they know more about the topic than I will ever know, right? They'll forget more than I know today. So that's like challenge number one. The second challenge is, there's so much noise and so many people out there that are talking and so many people that are bombarding you with messaging. And sometimes it's really nice emotional stories and those play and those are great, but it's very hard to cut through and I guess cut through all the noise and really get in and kind of slide into somebody's brain. And I guess from college, even before that, we're all trained to be sophisticated consumers and we're all trained to read charts. And I used to go through this exercise with people. If you imagine a chart, this is what people always love to do on podcasts. Imagine a chart. But if you imagine a chart with a line where the x-axis is somebody's life, I don't know, years, days, months, whatever it is, and the y-axis is number of cigarettes that person is smoking every day, and you plot out, hey, you can see a slight rise when this person's 9, and you see them start to smoke a little bit, and then they smoke a lot more when they're in college and it like spikes up a lot. And then they meet somebody and they get married and they have a kid and they stop smoking totally and it just drops down to zero. And then a couple of months later, a couple of years later, it goes back up and keeps on going up until whatever, they get cancer and pass away from it or something. If you just apply that in your head and think about it, there's an emotional component to that, that A, we're reading the data. So you're telling the story to yourself as a consumer, right? While you're reading the chart, you're telling the story to yourself and it hits you differently. It hits you differently because there's a level of credibility around it, whether it's true or not. And you're telling the story to yourself as you interpret the chart. And I think that's just, it's such a different direction in, but it is a very powerful and effective one if you're speaking to the right person. Those two different drives, it's a way for me to educate the person. And also it's a way for them to talk to themselves about it and walk themselves through the story. Both of those, when you combine them, become really powerful.
So I have to ask you, if it's such a powerful tool as a marketer, why don't we see more companies doing it?
I don't know. For the most part, I don't know. I really, it is the first thing I look at when I see new companies and when I consult to startups. I always think about that. I think one of the very legitimate reasons is that it's really hard to look at the data that you have to perform a data audit and try to figure out, what do I have and what do I not have and what can I share? There's an element and a very important element of what is private data, what can I talk about and what can I not talk about? Specifically with Freightos, I have the privilege of sitting on a ton of data, but a lot of it is exhaust data. It's not fundamental to my business, it's output. And I was able to identify it and say, hey, let's also use this, let's repurpose this for something else. But I think very frequently people underestimate how interesting and how useful benign pieces of information inside of their company may be. And how effective it is. Like how, I think my first data pickup was before we actually had enough data internally. There was a COP21, this like sustainability conference. And literally me and somebody on the team sat down. We opened up a bunch of academic articles that talked about logistics emissions. We performed our own back of the envelope meta-analysis. It took 20 minutes, like just like an Excel spreadsheet average, but it sounds a lot more interesting when I say meta-analysis. We compiled it, we sent it off to a Wall Street Journal reporter, and she led her reporting when she was talking about logistics at this COP, she led with that. And people don't understand, you don't need a ton of data. A decent Gartner report is going to have an N of 50. They'll have surveyed 50 people. You don't need so many data points. You just need to be able to find the right data points and compile it in the right way. And I think people really underestimate how easy it is to do that, as long as you know who you're speaking to and know what's interesting for them. You talked before about the storytelling, Paula. Like, part of it is, what is the data? But also, what's the story that I can overlay on top of that in order to understand, make it interesting? How do I like spin this a little bit without making stuff up? And how do I say, this is really interesting and this happened because of X, Y, or Z? You know, put a narrative on top of it, or really hammer home like why this is related to a trend that people need to understand.
Yeah, going back to why it's so hard to do, I think that at least in the companies I've worked in, really narrows it down, because usually there is an absurd amount of data. There's so much data, you don't know where to start, you don't know where to pull it from. So one of the challenges that I think your approach really solves is, if you have the story, it helps you, it guides you, right? You don't need to look through all the data, you need to look for specific pieces of that data that will help you tell a story that you probably already intuitively know from the fact of being in the business, right? Like, you probably know the trends and you just need those things to back it up. So I think having that story is the foundation of good marketing, but like, you need to have it top of mind when doing this effort. But just going back to something you said that resonates for me is the private versus the exhausted data. We're a public company and there's just a lot of information I am not allowed to share. Like, hard no from everyone in legal and finance and whatever. It's been very frustrating because sometimes like, but look how interesting it would be. And they're like, no, I'm sorry. That's a no.
Yeah, it's a challenge. I think it's been a huge struggle too. I definitely think that having the right legal counsel, somebody really understands, because there's always ways around it. Not in terms of leaking information, but there's a difference between a stupid example. If you want to put together a piece on who vacations better, right? So in the freight space, but we have strong penetration in Europe. So to say who takes off more days during summer vacation, right? And just compare on a day-to-day basis, which European countries are better at disconnecting or not as good at disconnecting. You might not be able to publish actual user data, the number of users, but you're probably able to include the percentage change, right? Year on year comparison, or aggregated enough to get rid of anything that might be, you know, really market moving. And if you have the right lawyer to work with, or if you understood enough about the rules yourself, you can usually negotiate your way to a pretty equitable solution.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. I think usually when you talk to certain people in a company, say, I would like to use some data for marketing, they're like, no way, you're crazy. That's not good. We're not going to let that happen. And then if you have the story and understand the limits of what is really a no-go and where there is some wiggle room, then like I said, you're less likely to get lost in the limitless amount of information there is, and also be able to have productive conversations with the people you need to in order to move the thing along. So yeah, I think that's really practical. Really
practical. Yeah, I'll also add, the main data, I would say probably about half, maybe a little bit more than half of the data that we use for marketing comes from internal sources. My favorite motion, because it's easiest, but I think it's also the most interesting for me, is just running surveys and getting input from our users. And if you build up a really solid cohort, 50, 100, you know, you could start with relatively small numbers of people that are filling out surveys that are meaty and are asking the right questions, but not too long, and you have the right filters on top of it, it's very easy to get a snowball running where, you know, you publish something based off of input that you're getting from actual practitioners. You gate that content. I'm still a believer in gated content, sorry. And people download it. You reach out to them for more surveys, and you just build this really great ongoing motion that establishes you as a thought leader based off of the thoughts that you're borrowing from other thought leaders in the space. And you use that to build additional credibility, and it never stops. And that doesn't need to be, that's not PII, it's not internal information. It's a really easy motion to get started, especially if you have a founder who has done 30 calls with different potential prospects. That's all you need to get started with a really solid industry survey. Like 30 people from people that know what they're talking about, that's gold if you have a five question survey.
Can you tell us a little bit more about how this evolved as a core part of Freightos' marketing strategy? Was it obvious from the beginning? Did you have to grow into that? And tell us more about how it is that you've leveraged your own data. What's some of the most interesting data that you've used and the stories that you've told? Mm-hmm. Take us through that journey.
It's a great question. I'll split it into three different chapters. Right. So chapter one is the exploration phase where you understand that there's something behind this and you just figure out how do you build into this motion? How do you rely on data to tell a more credible story? And some of the examples that I have are these like ridiculous ones. Everybody, every industry, I think everybody was always talking about Amazon. Wouldn't be able to do this now, but when you're a smaller startup and you can get away with things that you might do differently, at a certain point, I hired a guy on Upwork to scrape Amazon's career website for every supply chain role that was there and just ran a relatively simple data analysis on all the roles that Amazon was hiring for related to supply chain. And then we just like very basic analysis, things like which degrees are they looking for? What are the like different keywords that show up in their skill sets? What regions are they hiring for? What departments are they hiring for in supply chain? And obviously everybody in supply chain at the time wanted to work for Amazon too. So it got a ton of attention just when we published this, pitched it out to reporters. And I think for me, that was the first, okay, it doesn't even need to be my data. I could just find an interesting story around somebody else's data and tell it. I think that was an upside. The downside is what you learn is that if you go too far away from your sweet spot, right? If you wander too far away from something that's buy intent or product related, you start to get the attention, but it's not helpful attention. And then you get into this New York Times mode where you're publishing because you feel like suddenly you're a publication, not because you're a marketer that's actually supposed to drive leads and drive revenue. So that was like one example of that exploration. I think a aha moment for me that really dropped at the time we were selling software, the sales portal software. So a freight company can sell online from their own website to their customers. And the way that we decided to go big with that was we created a fake company and we basically did this mystery shopping exercise where using details from this fake company, we tried to get price quotes online from the top 20 freight companies. And we just documented the process. How long does it take? How many buttons do you need to press? How long did it take for them to get me back a quote? Was it plain text? Was it templated? What a bunch of different parameters. And we started off, I wasn't even thinking about the data publishing side of thing. We started off by taking that report and just sending it back to the top 20 companies with a blurred out page to say, hey, do you want to see how you compare benchmarked against all your other top 20 competitors? And that was driven from that main insight of probably the thing that most leaders at larger companies care about the most is how are they doing compared to their competitors? So that like was all driven by that like one idea. And we were able to show it to them in a way that they probably couldn't legally explore even, and it worked really well. And at a certain point, we're like, hey, we have all this data. Why don't we playbook it? Let's publish it as a report. Let's reach out to media. We'll get people interested in it. We ran it as LinkedIn ads and it was bringing in like $20, $30 cost per lead from very specific target audiences. So maybe a targeting audience of 2,500 people on LinkedIn, but really solid brand visibility. And we just started to playbook that. We started to do that again and again.
Have you repeat for an audience of 2,000 something people, you had a cost per lead of $20 to $30?
It was crazy. That's
insane.
Yes. I think that probably by now, as of last time I tried to run this with LinkedIn ads, the cost had probably doubled. Not a lot of money at all. I mean, when you compare it to the typical cost per lead in a space like this. Now, we had, I think, a little bit of an advantage in that the industry that I'm in has been a little bit slower to digitize. You know, it's not nearly as saturated. Probably if I was in cloud security, it would be much, much harder to do that. At the same time, it's the same thing that I was telling before. Are you finding the right data for the right people? They're going to want that information. You just need to get in front of them. So that was interesting in the data journey because it was, how do I get these users or their customers to generate the data? How do I package it correctly? And then how do I just let them use it themselves? And I think that was like chapter one, which was a lot of exploration and trying to figure out what works and what doesn't work. Chapter two for me was more, okay, let's come up with something more rigorous and playbook it and figure out how do we scale this as a marketing motion. And that relied, the first aha was really on taking the exhaust data that I talked about before. I still have this like email save where I said to my CEO, like, hey, why don't we take some of our data points and publish a weekly email that we send out to reporters and say, hey, here's how prices are changing on shipping from China to the United States West Coast and China to the United States East Coast. And we started to do it every single week. And it started a little bit slow, right? We got a couple of pickups here and there. We got a lot of angry people because it was an industry that didn't have a lot of transparency inside of it, which is sometimes good from a marketing perspective, at least, especially when I didn't have to deal with the phone calls. And over time, we stuck with it. We were just like very consistent every single week sending it out. It was like a custom email that I was writing with a little bit of editorializing on top of it. And it kept on getting a little bit more traction. And over time, we started to say, okay, let's expand it. let's add another couple of lanes here. Okay, let's maybe put up a weekly blog post instead of just sending out an email. And after a while, it reached the point, this was like very slow and then suddenly very fast, where we had a self-service website. We started having companies come and pay for information, literally 7-digit figure revenue coming from this idea that it started as an experiment of self-service data, but then COVID happened. And when COVID happened, we were just like right time, right place. All of the outreach that we had done for media where we had given them this data meant backlinks and gave us domain authority from an SEO perspective. When the reporters, whatever, AP or Reuters, whoever was looking for the data in the beginning, the early days of COVID, they found us and it snowballed to the point where every single week we're getting 5-6 mainstream media publications that were no touch. We had PR people, but they were just coming to us and taking the data directly from us. And it just never slowed down from there. It was a really helpful exercise. It was, I mean, very unlucky for the world, but very unlucky for us from a marketing perspective, at least, that we're just like sitting on that data. And we happen to be in a space that lends itself. And as we're recording this, there's, you know, tariffs that are being imposed for imports between the United States, you know, China and Mexico. Every time something like that happens, every time a ship gets stuck in the Suez Canal, every time there's a war and ships get rerouted around the Red Sea, it's just, we have become the go-to source for this. And that was this like scalable part of the journey. And that's, I think, stage two, which is building something that hit a need. I don't believe every single company could do this because we were in a space that did not have as much transparency and we were able to be first movers because it was exhaust. But we were able to playbook something that's interesting enough that people come to you instead of you having to reach out to them. Stage three was more, how do we add more product intent on top of it? How do you bring it a little bit closer to your product to make sure that people actually end up buying from you? One way to do that was to start selling the data, which we did, but I don't think every company really wants to do that. It's a distraction and, you know, I don't think it's appropriate for everybody. But really leaning into the survey side of things. And one of the pivotal moments for me there was we had a reporter from The Economist who reached out also during the earlier days of COVID, or maybe the end of 2020, and said, hey, do you have any data on how small businesses are feeling about increased freight rates? Yeah, we just ran a survey. Let me get you the data on that. I called up some of my team. We sat down at 11 o'clock and we wrote the survey about that. And we basically put together the survey within, you know, half an hour, 45 minutes, binged it out to, we have 40, 50,000 users that were opening up our emails and were fairly engaged, sent it out, got a good 1,000, 1,500 responses over the course of a day, compiled it, sent it out to the reporter from The Economist. And it was very product intent. It was how are small businesses feeling when they import their goods? One of our platforms let customers import their goods. And I think that for me was really good validation. And we just continue to do that, continue to come up with what are the survey questions we can ask? How do we compile it into a report? How do we get in front of people as well as possible?
There's something very interesting about all of the stages you talked about. And it, you said at some point, what makes an interesting industry survey? And I think if I think about all the surveys I see online or wherever, they're not all that interesting. They're not all interesting. It almost feels like someone is going through the motion of, I feel like I need to do a white paper. And what you've done is not only did you make it interesting to your buyers, but you also made it interesting to the media. And it's this self-feeding loop of, you know, one promotes and the other one eats it. It's very hard to do. And I'm sorry to put you on the spot, but you have some kind of, maybe recipe is the wrong word because it'll be different for every business, but something that I look for these qualities in the core subject of these studies that I know will connect with my buyer and with the media. Mm-hmm. How do you do the both of them?
So first of all, this is like a general disclaimer, I should say, for the entire podcast. I hate when people say that they have all the answers. I certainly don't have the answers in these playbooks. They work for me, but they might not work for everybody. And every single win that you have also comes with 10 losses. And it's really fun to like talk about the wins. But I've sent out in crazy amounts of surveys that like fell flat and that we scrambled to get 16 people that fill it out, or that you get it and it's full of junk data, or you run a whole survey and the data that you come back is totally inconclusive. So there's a lot of misses, right? Even whatever, you know, even like top tier baseball players will only hit 350-400%. Like you're going to miss a whole lot more. That said, one of the paradigms I think is interesting to bear in mind when you run these surveys, but really in general, when you create content, is what is interesting? And trying to value your reader's time as much as you value your own time. I think we all have been setting the bar for what you read higher and higher and higher. And this is what's so hard B2B in general, but content marketers as a whole, you're competing with the best writers in the world who are giving their content away for free, right? You're competing with the Substacks and you're competing with New York Times or Wall Street Journal, and you can get all that information for free. And instead, somebody's going to choose to read my stupid white paper about international freight. And when you get into that mindset, you realize that the bar that you set for yourself and for your content needs to be really high. I think that the people that are best at doing like this type of assessment are people that have been burnt a lot pitching to reporters. I think having a PR background for this really helps, because you come up with a really good sense of, I can't pitch this like stupid feature launch. No one's going to care about this feature launch. I need to connect this to a bigger story. And then you could still get burnt because there might be a bigger story that happened that day.
How do you think about the sort of prioritization that goes into telling a story that is just a big general kind of brand story and it's getting your name out there versus something that is super targeted, and just how you spend your time? You can't do everything. These are really time-consuming efforts. How do you do that? And has your thinking around that evolved?
Oh my God, that's a wonderful question. It really depends who you're talking to. I think this is about all marketing activity as a whole. I like sat down with one of our investors at a certain point. I was like, hey, I'm no longer going to be pitching for TechCrunch and Verge. I think that my readers don't read TechCrunch and Verge. I'd rather get a pickup in American Shipper or, you know, some other publication that I hope you never have to read. But, you know, I'd rather get a pickup in American Shipper than TechCrunch, because it's just not, there's nothing there for me.
Your investor was like, but how will the other investors find it?
Exactly. Yeah, so there's the signaling, exactly. And looking back, I think that there's areas where that we lost, because then there's like a bunch of gain because of that clarity, because you can't be everywhere. You're absolutely right. You can't be everywhere at once. Looking back, I'm surprised by how much broader lift we got from having the foundation of data. And some of that lift is in the shape of SEO, right? Which is just a little bit hard to quantify, but you have more domain authority. Some of it is in brand familiarity. There's a ton of people that I'll reach out to them and they'll say, sure, I know Freightos. I've no clue what you do, but I know Freightos. The number of times that we have to reach out to reporters who will cite our data as Freightos, a freight data platform rather than an online marketplace is enormous. But you still get this like general somewhere in the ether, you're there. And that makes it a little bit easier when you reach out to people. I think you can only afford to do it if you're also augmenting that with other channels that are actually driving a revenue pipeline. If you can connect them, then it's great. One surprising aspect when it comes to this freight data stuff, over time, one of the things that we added on top of the self-service platform was we have this amazing consultant in-house. He's basically like a freight analyst. And he puts together these weekly emails using our data, primarily our data, that goes out to a list of I don't know, 50, 60, 70,000 people that read it every single week. And what we realized over time is that the people that start reading that email newsletter, 2 years later, 2.5 years later, start to buy your services. And I would, if I was running an aggressive ROI calculation, what is my return on ad spend for this person's salary versus when I'm getting my, you know, investment back? You would not still be employed. But if you are able to take that longer view, suddenly you realize how valuable that is. And I think that you have to be able to say, hey, this is not going to work for me today. Can I afford to invest in this for 2.5 years or 3 years before I start to see investment? And do I have a Band-Aid, or do I have another channel on top of this that is scratching my short-term itch, so that long-term I'll be able to also, you know, augment it with this like data stuff. But it's hard. And there were times when I proposed to our CEO that we stop it. And, and you know, I think he had the foresight to be able to say, no, keep it going. It's worth it. It's not a huge investment. And long-term, it really validated itself. But it's a marathon. It's not a sprint.
I think that's, you know, in B2B marketing, because the sales cycles are so long, it's very hard to get very quick metrics of, is this working? Is this not? Especially if your key metric is, did it bring a lead that closed, right? That's the ultimate one you want to connect to. But do you have data that you look at internally for hints that there's something there? Like when you cannot connect it necessarily to an MQL or a closed deal?
I think there's a lot of different data points that you could come up with, but they all rest on, can you come up with a hypothesis or an explanation for yourself that you really actually believe? I can come up with any KPI, but do I actually believe that this is like gonna bring value? For me, one of the more esoteric, but I think interesting data points that I like to look at is how many people are registering to this email newsletter because they were forwarded it by a friend. And for me, that doesn't necessarily mean I'm getting revenue out of it, but it means my target market is enjoying the content. They're amplifying the content, and they're amplifying it to colleagues in the same space that also enjoy the content enough that they're coming in top of funnel. That's a very leading KPI that I've reached like content market fit with what we're putting together. The second interesting KPI to track on it is when I want to cash in on this brand equity, I might not be able to get somebody to sign a deal immediately because they're registered to this list. But when I want to cash in and I want to convert people into registering for a webinar, right? When I want to cash in and convert it into somebody voting for us for some award or for somebody downloading a white paper or somebody just reading another post on my website, how effective am I at doing that? Can I get the person who writes the weekly emails to put in a PS that says, hey, we'd really appreciate if you like this LinkedIn post? And can I cash in on that? And when you can do that, then you understand, okay, I've built up brand affinity. I've built up a relationship with my readers, and I can actually turn this into something effective. And then long term, this is also not something that I haven't even bothered on necessarily analyzing and playbooking it. But over time, you start looking back at the different points of, you know, touch points, and every single time you'll see open email decks, the number of emails that they've opened, and you understand these people have been engaged with you for 2 years, 3 years.
Would you say that, you know, data storytelling, data-driven marketing, whatever you call it, is it a more effective way of building trust and building reputation? With a lot of content marketing, there's a bit of a trust issue of this is just here to be like transactional. So do you think that data storytelling done well gets around that in some way?
Yes, but it's so easy to lose the trust if you screw up. Right? It's a very fickle relationship that you've built in that, you know, people are coming to you and they're trusting you. I've been thinking a ton about trust specifically over the past year and a half or 2 years since AI has really taken off, when the marginal cost to create content has gone down to zero. And we all know that there's, you know, so many people that just automatically reply to your LinkedIn posts, and you're just like, you don't know who to trust anymore. And I've been split trust into two different like buckets. There's like the people that I know, and because I know them, I trust them, and I trust the stuff that they trust. And then the second part of that trust is this like organizational trust. Do I trust this logo for some reason? Do I trust Andreessen Horowitz? Do I trust Wix? Do I trust Yahoo? And there's all these different companies, not say where I land, but if you look at OpenAI versus Anthropic and ask yourself, which of these brands do I trust and why? I think each person comes up with their own answer for different reasons. Maybe it's because of like leadership changes at one of the organizations. Data is a way to build up the institutional trust in the organization rather than an individual person. That is, it cuts really deep because the reader, the consumer, no longer looks at that organization as somebody that's trying to take something from them, but the organization has been educating them, and that organization has been doing it very generously, and they've been sharing information, and they've been helping out, and you can trust them when that organization reaches out to you. Hey, I actually think you feel like you owe them to a certain extent, but you also believe that they know what they're talking about. They're not just like some fly-by-night organization.
So related to that, you mentioned that you still believe in gated content, which I get, B2B. I'm not sure I believe in it. I'm not sure I don't. And the reason that I'm on the fence is because when I've, as a user, have engaged with gated content, the actual value typically falls short from the ad or the title, whatever. There's something and I'm like, oh, wow, this is really interesting. I will give you my email in exchange for this information. And then you send it and then you realize actually the title is the most useful thing about this paper, this whatever. There's an interesting dynamic between gated content in terms of trust, because you as a consumer of this information are trusting this brand that if I give you private information about myself so that you'll probably call me or reach out to me later, like it's worth whatever you're going to give me in exchange. So I give you something first.
Right.
And then if you don't give me what you promised, I already gave it to you. Like it's right. Done. And now that might make me less likely to engage with the salesperson that reaches out after, but it kind of burns, you know, yeah. It burns everybody.
I agree. I think I believe in gated content because I think we need to right now. There's no discovery channel is ever permanent. And, mm-hmm. You know, somebody, whatever, Googles your research or clicks on it from a publication. And if they consume it and they get a tremendous amount of value from it, they're still here today, gone tomorrow. And right, I mean, if there's anything that has been permanent in B2B marketing over the past 10 years, is that you need to own your own audience. Right. And that means that as quickly as possible, somehow, you need to get people off of their discovery channel and into an owned audience. And the best way to do that consistently has remains email, I think. Now, does that mean that you need to do gated content? If you have content that is so grade A+, that somebody finishes it, they read it all and they say, oh my God, this was so good. I got to sign up for their email newsletter. I got to subscribe to get more. That might happen, but that's still going to be a very low conversion funnel, right? You're still not going to get most of the people there. But I think it's a necessary evil. You need to capture an email. And even with the best content in the world, it's going to be hard to capture that email. Therefore, how do we make gated content that respects the user? Because Paul, that's what you're talking about. You're saying, like, how do we make sure that you continue to respect the user? And I think the way that you do that is you give phenomenal stuff away for free. You don't have a squeeze page that says, hey, click this to learn how many people did X, Y, and Z. You say, X number of people did X, Y, and Z. To understand the reasons behind it, click and download the paper. So you're giving away more value up front. You can't gate the actual value, but you can gate additional value behind it. You can follow through on that. And you can also recognize that a content download is not a lead. And you're going to annoy your salesperson if you pass it on as a qualified lead. You're going to annoy the user if you do that. Like there needs to be a nurture cadence. And frankly, in a lot of cases, we have not put nurture cadences in place because we've gotten sometimes you have your content, you publish it, and like the person downloads it and you don't do anything with the email. And for us, that net of these like weekly emails that you can send out that are just raw value without asking for anything in return has become like the pure sense of a nurture email because you're not asking for anything. You gave them value with the content. You came through on that content promise. And then you're just continuing to drive value for them without ever asking for anything.
For companies that are thinking about getting started on their data storytelling journey, who do they need on their team?
I think that my expectation of a really good marketer these days is to some extent like a jack of all trades. The old T-shaped marketer kind of thing where you have all the skills and then you go really deep on one. You need all those skills. This for a long time was one of our main interview exercises we do when we interview people. I'm not a huge fan of these massive take-home tests, but I do like giving somebody 30 minutes where you give them a data set and you say, come up with the story based off this data set and write a pitch email to a reporter. And even if you're not in PR, being able to think about how do I look at this data? How do I run a very basic like Google Sheet analysis? Just like averages and medians, nothing that you wouldn't need past like ninth grade math. How do you take that and how do you extrapolate or extract a story from that? And then how do you package that story? That's a skill set that most marketers, certainly people on the PR or content side, should have as like a day one value. That's like marketing 101, I think, these days. In my experience, the reporters want to get this information. They'll ask for the data. And because you're not really pitching a story, you're just giving them raw information, it's a little bit, it's relatively easy, all things said, to get those data points placed. So I would not go out and hire the PR person for the sake of outreach. I would hire them because they know how to tell a good story and hopefully they know how to like run like a little bit of Google Sheet analyses.
Early on though, were you pitching the story? Now they know, reach out to Freightos because they have this kind of data.
Early on, we didn't pitch it as a story. Hey, we're launching this index. I think it was really just reaching out to people on Twitter. I'm trying to think when it was. I feel like reaching out to people on MySpace and asking. We just reached out to reporters and said, hey, here's this week's data. Would you like to continue to get this data every single week? And if they said yes, then we would send it. And if not, then we wouldn't send it. Yeah. And that's not something that you need a PR agent to do. You need an email address in order to do that, or just like a Twitter handle or something to reach out to somebody. If I had to find one role that it's really about, I think it's a content muscle more than anything else. And I think if you know how to use ChatGPT, I think it's a very basic way to use ChatGPT. Like, what are the interesting stories here? Here's my persona. Give me five stories.
So 2025, January's been off to a slow start in terms of global trade stories. Sarcasm. What are the stories that you're looking forward to telling this year?
I have no clue. I think that this shapes content plans. So you're trying to take it to Freight. And I'm like, no, I'm going to talk about marketing, Sasha. You can't make me talk about Freight in this podcast. I think if you're running this type of motion, it's very hard to build a content plan because so much of it is dependent on what's interesting for the user. And so much of what's interesting to the user is dependent on what's happening today. It's very difficult to the point where I think we probably only plan out 25 to 50% of our reports in the beginning of the year, and everything else is every once in a while looking up and seeing what's happening. Saturday night or Sunday morning, it's, hey guys, this is happening right now with the tariffs. This is what we're going to be all in on. By Sunday afternoon, let's make sure that we have a decent analysis. Let's make sure that we have something that we can send out to reporters. Let's make sure that it's reflecting their data platform, and let's make sure that we're capitalizing on this by educating our users as much as possible. And then just being able to keep on doing that whenever you need to, and really, right now at least, resisting the urge to go out of your comfort zone and staying with what best, even within this very specific, or well, seemingly very specific area of international trade, saying, I don't know more about global trade patterns and U.S. customs than another expert, but I sure as hell know more about international freight. And I could say, hey, this is going to make air cargo prices go up, or this is really going to hurt United Airlines' bottom line, or would really help their bottom line, and really staying in my comfort zone, but making sure that I'm educating as much as possible. I think for the most part, it's staying within that space and looking at what's happening, what's changing. Where we do look at the kind of do plan out our data a little bit more is looking at when we have really fundamental launches, product launches, feature launches, and then trying to think, what is the data that I'm going to need in order to tell an interesting story about that? And then more proactively going out to find that data. If we're launching a new product related to online sales, what are all the data points around online sales, and like reaching out and starting to make sure that you have all your ducks in a row so you can go to market with a good data marketing strategy there. A lot of this, when I think about it, it sounds like very fluffy. You're talking about like the PR side of things, but there's very tangible stuff. Like when you have a good data motion, you also can do a lot of programmatic SEO, right? It's very easy to just generate thousands of pages at a time and put it together. You can make these automated reports that you send out to people, and you know, can check the open rates. You can let people subscribe to different levels. There's so much actual meat behind this that really speaks to me too, because you can really measure it.
No, it doesn't sound fluffy to me at all. It sounds like a super effective way to feed that content flywheel and to just generate so much actually valuable content.
Yeah.
I think that the value here is what's key. Is there's so much just like bad content out there.
Yeah. And this isn't going to cover everything, but it's a great way to start. But one helpful tip, by the way, when it comes to looking internally at what data you can do, is speaking to your data team and asking them which like SQL databases are being queried the most frequently, which internally, which tables are being used the most, which data sets are being used the most. And usually those are ones that are going to have the most interesting data. And even asking for an export of what are the columns inside of those data sets, just what you have to work with, and then start messing around with it and trying to come up with ideas around it. I promise that's the most geeky I'll get.
That's great. I'm really writing that down. I'm in the process of doing a data-oriented content marketing effort. And the
perfect.
No, but what I told our analysts, they were like, you want to do what? There's 300 million users. What do you want to know? And I'm like, oh, I have a list. Don't worry.
I want to know everything.
You only know the things you know. And this is very interesting because that'll give me insights into what is interesting to other people in the organization, not just to me. And that will trigger some good brainstorming for sure. Good tip.
This has been such an interesting conversation. Yeah. I think very different from any of the conversations we've had up until this point. Thank you for...
Here's hoping that's a good thing. Okay.
Not that the other ones weren't interesting.
It's like, anytime, you're so different.
No, in a good way. Like, very cool insights here. Before we let you go, Eitan, we ask this of all of our guests, because we like to think about what is inspiring the inspired marketer. And so we like to ask, who are you following? What are you listening to? And what are you reading? What is keeping you inspired?
All good questions. So who do I follow? I would say I mostly follow an anthropologist, trying to look outside at, hey, why is this animating me? I actually try not to follow the typical marketing thought leaders, because I just feel like there's a lot of misinformation or writing for the feed rather than actually sharing the hard insights. One organization that does really stick out is Fletch, who put out these amazing content about product marketing. Anthony Pieri and Robert Kaminsky, I think his name is. Just phenomenal insights about product marketing. And every time I see a post that I really like, it's theirs. And I follow friends. I follow folks that I know are phenomenal marketers, but who aren't necessarily posting about marketing. I follow them to see what they're doing at their organization. Because you see, that's people that follow these, hey, here's my LinkedIn playbook, they're not sharing their playbook because they're too busy crushing it with their playbook. And you just have to watch their playbook and you have to see how they're doing it. Find the people that you really think are amazing marketers and just see what they're posting. And that's who I'm following.
That's so counterintuitive.
People just don't share.
Playbooks are the ones that have got really good playbooks.
Exactly. Yeah, it's exactly. They're not sharing.
Yeah.
So I think that's on the following side. On the reading side, more on the process side than anything else, the biggest change in my life over the past 2 years has been I started getting very much better at tracking what I read and actually making sure that I capture it, because there's so much that was coming in and then going out the other side. So I don't have any relationship with them. There's a company called Readwise that make this platform called Reader that makes it really easy to like highlight stuff. And I read 30, 40 articles a day. I use my books there and I just highlight stuff and I take notes and I just have a list of every single thing I've read, which is so, so, so fun. I would say that I do not read marketing books as much. I like really like stepping out a little bit. I think Stripe has this amazing initiative called Stripe Press, where they publish books. And they have some great books. There's like diary of the guy who made Prince of Persia. And he just takes you through his like entire process of when he made Prince of Persia, which I loved. And then some folks like, you know, Ben Thompson from Stratechery. But really, I think stepping outside of the marketing world and trying to figure out what's happening in the real world. And then it's my job to map that onto marketing. On the listening side, besides Wick Studio, right, they're just the best podcast in the world, obviously. Podcasts, I would say Acquired and Invest the Best, which like sounds like the corniest name, but is a really solid name. But my favorite thing to listen to is comedy. I think also, even like if I had to justify it from a marketing perspective, comedians know delivery and they know how to work their audience and they know how to build up a pace and they know how to just create a connection correctly. So that's why I expense my comedy shows. but I really, John Mulaney, Mitch Hedberg, I use that really as a time just to step back a little bit. But I think if I try to wrap it all together, I think there's only so much you can learn about marketing from reading about marketing or listening about marketing. And what it really comes down to is just like getting out there, messing around with stuff yourself and seeing what works and what doesn't work.
That's right. You've got to do it. You've got to iterate. You've got to try new things.
Exactly.
Yeah. And like you said, you might mess up a couple times and then you're going to hit on like an amazing data story and it'll get picked up by the New York Times and have incredible.
And they call you a nerd in the headline.
Right. Eitan, thank you so much for joining us. That is it for this episode of Funnel Vision. You can find us on all of the major podcast platforms, and we'll be posting the full interview on YouTube under the Wix Studio page. Be sure to hit subscribe to stay up to date on our latest episode. You can also find lots of great resources for marketers at our Content Hub linked below or in the show notes.